Hey, welcome everyone. I'm Louis Schwartzberg. I'm going to be your host. And many of you know me from the films I make that celebrate life, making the invisible visible by taking viewers on journeys through time and scale, like my recent film, Fantastic Fungi. You know, in my work, I always try to combine the how of science and the why of art. And I've always seen wonder and awe as that intersection between both of them. And this podcast really fills that sweet spot. And, you know, what I've learned from my many years of personal experience and filmmaking is that immersion in nature increases our capacity for courage, for creativity, compassion, the components we need in order to create a world where life can flourish. That's why today I'm really proud to say that our sponsor, the Fetzer Institute, they're helping to build the spiritual foundation for a loving world. In Fetzer's new study, What Does Spirituality Mean to Us? The U.S. meaning the United States. Very relevant considering the events that have gone on this last week, because it informs our understanding of ourselves and each other and inspires us to take action for the common good. You can explore these findings and more at spiritualitystudy.org. I want to invite you to also share your questions for our guests throughout the live broadcast. And please submit your questions in the comments section of the live stream. Our team will be reading all of them. And don't forget to tell us where you're coming from so we can feel this global connection. I'm really honored that my guest today, who spent years exploring the brain and understanding the importance of awe when it comes to the mind, body, and soul, I'm proud to welcome Jason Silva to our Wonder and Awe podcast. He's a dear friend. He's also an Emmy-nominated TV personality, filmmaker, and futurist. And he's known for the global TV series Brain Games, which was on National Geographic. And where he invited experts in the areas of neuroscience and psychology to perform experiments to explore the depth of the human brain, as well as his own inspirational videos that I truly love, called Shots of Awe, exploring futurism, technology, creativity, the science of awe and mental health. He's also an in-demand inspirational speaker and has presented all over the world. His work calls on people to ponder the miracle of life, the evolution of intelligence, and why we need awe. So, Jason, welcome to the conversation. It's been a while.
Hi. Thanks, Louis. Thanks for having me on your podcast, Wonder and Awe, two of our favorite words, favorite positive emotions, no doubt. I think you and I bonded originally just over our shared enthusiasm for living in the space of awe and wonder where science and art overlap. And so feels like full circle to be in your special podcast. Thanks for having me, brother. And thanks for the work you do.
I think the way we got connected was a good friend of mine said, you got to watch this guy's, you know, videos. Like what he does with words is what you do with imagery. And then bingo. Like that's what I really wanted to. And we connected. And we made a couple of short films together.
That's right.
Short, which we're going to share on today's podcast. You know, because we want to turn everybody on to being in the moment, to being in the divine, to have that aha moment that we all cherish, right?
I couldn't agree more. Even your description of taking people on journeys in time and scale, it speaks to me immediately. I mean, that's kind of the miracle of time-lapse photography. The work you do is you reveal a natural world, the way that it exists beyond the constraints of our nervous system, beyond the constraints of our perception. And you use, again, technology, right, which is a product of science and craft, to then, you know, deploy these tools in an artistic way to show us the world beyond our doors of perception. So you're doing the work of Aldous Huxley in a way with your filmmaking, and I appreciate that very much.
Well, you take me on a journey all the time when you can just be in the flow and do these incredible they're not rants, but they're almost like, you know, connecting, I think, to the deeper consciousness. And so, you know, what I'd like to do right now is I want to show the Wonder video that we have.
Great.
Because this is an example of, you know, asking Jason the question, like, what do you think about wonder and awe? And then I was able to add some imagery to it. So, Sean, if we cue that up now, I feel now is a good time to show it.
Great.
Wonder and awe. Oh, my God. My favorite topics. Wonder and awe is experientially the antidote to existential dread. And this is actually backed by science. There's been some research out of Stanford and out of Berkeley, the Greater Good Science Center, in which they describe awe as an experience of such perceptual expansion, such perceptual vastness, that it forces you to reconfigure your mental maps of the world in order to assimilate the experience that's happening. So imagine staring at images of the deep field of the universe for the first time, or seeing the Grand Canyon for the first time. The point being, your entire body mind is arrested by something perceptually larger than yourself, something so big it leaves no room for anything else. You are held in aesthetic arrest. You become what you behold, as Terence McKenna used to say. And these exhilarating neurostorms of intense intellectual pleasure leave all kind of residual lasting benefits. So you are left with increased feelings of well-being, increased feelings of compassion, increased feelings of creativity. So it turns out that blowing your own mind is medicinal. It turns out that experiences of aesthetic arrest are good for the soul, right? We become purged in a moment of egoless communion with the divine. And the idea of mediating these ecstasies with technology, right? Technologies like the microscope and the telescope to reveal the micro and the macro, or technologies like time lapse, which actually allow us to step outside of time, finally, are ways to get out of the limitations of our own nervous system so that we can transcend our own egoic perspective and actually hack into a sort of grander POV, to become like Neo in the Matrix and finally see the code. Awe and wonder, you know, romantic love also, all these experiences are ways to step off the people mover that's carrying everyone else towards death. When we step out of time, we transcend our finitude and we become infinite. So.
Brings me back.
So Jason, what do you think is happening to the brain when you're
in my brain,
wonder and awe? What do you think?
Well, I think for me, my creative process, when I'm riffing, I'm definitely writing what Rich Doyle, who wrote Darwin's Pharmacy, describes as a butterfly effect in thought. Stephen Kotler, who co-wrote Stealing Fire and who wrote The Rise of Superman, he writes about flow states, says that what I'm doing is I'm free associating, essentially, which is the same thing that freestyle rappers do. They often will like smoke a blunt and then they go like spit rhymes, but they're freestyling, which means that they might have an idea of like what they want to start with, but they're relying on or kind of trusting that their brain is going to leap from thought to thought and create that string of associations in real time. So it's like this flow that occurs between discipline and surrender. Discipline is, you know, all the books you've read, all the things you've thought about, the time that you've been consumed with, you know, when thinking about all these ideas. So that's the discipline. Then the surrender is to let all that go and see what emerges in the moment, right? You know, like trust your training. And so in a way, when you see me doing those riffs, it reveals as much about my ability to get out of my own way as it also reveals about my judiciousness, discipline, neuroticism, obsession with ideas, with words, with language, with explanation, which is also a part of my persona. As Flaubert said, be disciplined and orderly in your life so you can be violent and original in your work. So yeah.
So, you know, for me, Jason, the way I get into it a lot is obviously by filming nature.
Yeah.
So, and I think there's been a lot of studies that do talk about the fact that, you know, nature, you know, forest bathing, all these experiences
definitely
enables you to become more present. And when you become more present, then in a sense you become the observer, you know, and then you get rid of the preconceived notions. It's all about terra incognita. And so I'm just kind of curious, like how do you do that deep dive for you? You talked about it a little bit, but specifically once you're there, where do you go from there?
Yeah. So Michael Pollan wrote about this in his book, How to Change Your Mind. And he also wrote about this in the chapter on cannabis in his previous book, The Botany of Desire.
Which I love.
But yeah, me too. So he said that kind of the default setting of the brain is one that sort of blocks our capacity to be fully present. So what the brain is doing all at once is taking data from the present, quickly comparing it with data from the past and using that to predict the future, right? So the brain is a prediction machine and it's doing that. It's sort of pre-mapping the terrain so that you're not sidelined or surprised by a lion behind the bushes. So you're in a state of perpetual hypervigilance. And in his words, the good news is you're seldom surprised. The bad news is you're seldom surprised, right? So in a sense, it's the been there's and seen that's of the adult mind. It's like everything's being pre-mapped. Nothing's going to sideline me because I see everything coming a mile away. But what that means also is that you're never unexpectedly surprised and delighted by the majesty of the world because everything's been, again, pre-mapped, pre-tiled with language, pre-described. You've leapfrogged to the conclusion rather than rediscovered with a kind of virginal noticing the astonishing resplendence of the present moment. And so he goes on in the preface. He says that certain experiences, and in this he includes, let's say, travel or exposure to novelty or certain kinds of drugs, is that these drugs or travel or novelty seem to engender what he calls a blocking of all signals forwards and backwards in the brain. So what I described before of the brain comparing the present with the past and predicting the future, that machination seems to get thrown offline. You know, in psychedelic research, they describe it as the default mode network or the autobiographical ego. It gets knocked offline. So when you can't compare things with the past and pre-map the future, he writes, you're hurled into the flow of the present, a present that is literally wonder-full, the present that is wonderful, the flow of the present that is literally wonderful. And he goes on, wonder being the byproduct of that unencumbered sense of first sight to which the adult brain has closed itself, right? With all of that pre-mapping and pre-assessing and pre-vigilant. And so instead, you're open, you're vulnerable, you're transparent. Everything is a surprise, right? Moment to moment. He says your pool of sense impressions fills, but then empties as quickly as it fills. So you're just like showing up to the present moment again and again and again every instant. And that to me is the beginning of sacred space. That's mythopoetic space. That's liminal space. That's waking dream space. That's the space of the poets. That's when the world shows up for you in a grain of sand and heaven in a wild flower. You know, that's Blake's infinity in the palms of your hand and eternity in an hour. And the reason is that, as Henry Miller said, even a blade of grass, when looked at with complete attention and no preconceptions, becomes a magnificent infinite world in itself, something that your films reveal through your transcendence of time and scale, right? Time-lapse photography does the same thing. It takes an ordinary world that you've pre-mapped, right, and pre-decided about and sort of decide, no longer are looking at, and reveals, right, one little blade of grass or one little bubble of water, a drop of water. I mean, oh my God, all of a sudden it becomes the universe in a grain of sand. And so I like to go to that space because when I'm in that space, as Jamie Wheel has described it, you feed the holy. You know, there's a relief and liberation that comes from the quieting of the chatter, from the transcendence or the uncoupling of time, or at least mechanized cognition, right? What the Greeks call chronos, and instead portaling or stargating into kairos. You know, mythopoetic space is a space in which time becomes liquid. And, you know, when you're in that space, instead of your mind wrapping itself around consensus reality or mechanized cognition, right? Instead, time wraps itself around your mind and your experience. And so what's really nice about that is like your interiority spills out into the external terrain. You appropriate the landscapes around you and they inform your inner life, and your inner life informs the external landscape. But sacred space has to be protected. This has to occur in the magic circle. You don't want to be in that state when you're crossing a freeway or when there's a red light and a green light. It's very important that you have these experiences or engender these experiences protected and separated from default world mechanized cognition, chronos. You know, you have to transcend the chronopression to create these spaces for you know, illumination, as you might describe them. And for me, that's how I feed the holy. And from there, my content becomes essentially a trip report. You know, all my videos are just transcriptions, right? I mean, comes through you, but not from you. And though it is with you, it belongs not to you, like Khalil Gibran wrote about our children. But my videos are my children. But I'm only reporting what is unfolding. You know, I'm marshaling a response in direct proportion to the intensity of the experience. So I don't have to plan anything for my content other than to engender sacred space, and from which then I will always marshal a response. Just like Jodie Foster after she goes through the wormhole in Contact and she says, they should have sent a poet. They should have sent a poet because, you know, once the world is seen, you know, in a blade of grass, the only response is poetry.
It's quite true. You know, one of the things, you know, I think we both deeply feel too when you're in that moment of bliss and the sacred and the holy is the oneness of everything, that interconnection of everything.
Yeah.
You know, that's why I love shooting these patterns of nature, that whether it's like a footprint on Mars or a footprint on the beach or the back of a leaf or an aerial over a river landscape, I'm looking at the same pattern. And that pattern is intelligence. It's divine intelligence. I mean, scientists look at it and go, oh, that's the most efficient way to move nutrients, right? You know,
sure.
Or, you know, okay. But yeah, efficiency is beauty. And beauty is the orchestration of life on our planet, you know?
Oh, yeah. And efficiency is also intelligent, right? I mean, efficiency is manifestation of problem solving, optimizing. You know, it's like having design in nature that perhaps doesn't require a designer, but design itself does emerge. So complexity and design and the smarter way of doing things through selection pressure emerges. So right. That means that whether or not there's a designer, well, that's another debate, but design itself, intelligence itself is manifest in the natural world. It just is, it exists.
Well, it also has the benefit of 3.5 billion years of R&D, you know, of trial and error, of 100%. Being able to like figure out what is the ultimate way for life to go forward, you know?
100%. And I like to also say, you know, we are in some ways a sort of a cutting edge emergent thing because we can turn around and look at ourselves and we are the natural world, I do believe, right? We emerge from the biosphere. And so us reflecting on ourselves and us reflecting on the natural world is the cosmos knowing itself, as Carl Sagan would say.
Yeah. And
if we were to utilize this capacity to its greatest potential, there's nothing we couldn't do. The forms of beauty, truth, poetry that we could shine a light on and participate in the creation of is beyond measure.
Yeah. Well, that's why biomimicry, you know, for me is like, you know, a couple of things, a real practical solution for how we can live sustainably on the planet. You've got all of these like patterns and systems that work in harmony that don't waste a single molecule. So on a practical level, that's really good. But I also think on a spiritual level, yeah, it's a moral compass, because what I learned when I did Fantastic Fungi, which is something I did not know when I started, you know, the movie, is that, you know, communities survive better than individuals. You know, that's how ecosystems flourish. It's a shared economy under the ground without greed, so that everybody wins. And that's like a pattern, or that we could perhaps elevate into, you know, what is the social replication or model of that, correct? What kind of nature that can shift our behavior and our society?
It's beautiful. I mean, it reminds me of that South African saying, Ubuntu, I am because you are. And I could say that also to the trees, you know, I am because you are, otherwise I can't breathe and I don't exist. And I think the astronauts, when they have the overview effect, also they see the Earth from space and they experience Ubuntu. I am because you are, planet Earth, no doubt. And I think what's exciting about people undergoing mystical type experiences, whether it's through experimenting with cannabis or other psychoactive compounds, there's a lot of research now, as you know, with psilocybin, others. People that one of the hallmarks of a psychedelic experience or a mystical experience or a spiritual experience is are profound somatic, right? Like really in the body, feelings of interconnection, right? Like feeling connected to the world the way you feel connected to your child, something that is enough to shift behavior, you know, move your moral compass. However, I would still caution that, you know, feeling connected to everything and one with everything is beautiful. But I also think it's equally beautiful to celebrate your splendid uniqueness as a unique snowflake. Because what I don't want is in the excitement or the enthusiasm of becoming one with everything that we dismiss our splendid uniqueness. I still think Beethoven and Mozart and Louis Schwarzberg are exceptional people. So I'm still a hardened individualist, even though I celebrate that we are both individuals and connected to the whole. Because there's been too many examples in our history where the individual was sacrificed for an idea of the collective, and that led to the Soviet Union. So I don't want, you know, a runaway train of ecological consciousness to turn into something that gets corrupted and sacrifices individual vitality and creativity and contribution. Does that make sense?
It does, because I think you're more than an individual. You're actually a walking universe. There's a trillion cells in your body. You know, you are a mega giant. I mean, human beings are the largest living creatures on the planet. They are in the 80th percentile of size and weight on the planet. So we are definitely like walking giants.
And walking miracles of self-organization, you know, emergent complexity, homeostasis. I mean, just the whole thing. You know, we're made of feedback loops as well that are governing the behavior of our cells and molecules all the time. I once read an article that said the DNA double helix is a great sort of symbol or metaphor for life, but an even better metaphor might be the feedback loop. And the feedback loop points to systems thinking and cybernetics. And what's interesting about cybernetics is we're used to thinking about cybernetics in computer systems. But the truth is that nature is the ultimate cybernetic system. And you probably heard of the term cyberdelics. Cyberdelics is where cybernetics and psychedelics kind of overlap. It's sort of a lens of perception through which to make sense of reality. And what you might call psychedelic transhumanists or cyberdelic thinkers include people like Timothy Leary and Terence McKenna, for example.
You know, Jason, I know some of your rants definitely talk about psychedelics. There's actually a psychedelic movement that's occurring currently throughout the world.
Yeah.
With Fantastic Fungi, one of our, you know, affiliate partners everywhere we've opened up a theater has been like the local psychedelic chapter. And what's great about the that connection I have with this group. Like any film, I'd say, look, here we have a film about Save the Whales. You got people that are environmentalists. We might be about any other issue. The people that are part of this movement are so passionate, are so engaged, because I believe there's a spiritual, you know, vision or practice that people have wanted to engage in that's been suppressed, you know, just like, you know, spiritual thought leaders or religions in the past. And when you put a lid on something, it wants to explode, whether it was, the gay liberation movement or, you know, cannabis. When it pops, it really does pop. Yeah. And I'm curious to get your thinking on, what do you see happening? Because I think we're pretty interesting, you know, time in history. There's a breakthrough. We got what's going on in Washington, D.C. right now.
Yeah.
Like a breakdown. But at the same time, whether it's technology or the psychedelic movement, is like a 180-degree opposite of a breakthrough.
Yeah. No, I think it's a very exciting space. It's a very exciting space because we're living through an epidemic of mental distress, right? The depression, the anxiety level, the people on benzos and sedatives to sort of numb their angst is horrific. And then we have, I think, more people committing suicide now than are dying from natural disasters and armed conflict combined, according to a United Nations figure that I saw. So it's a problem, and the traditional interventions aren't working. What's exciting about psychedelic research, obviously people might have read about what's happening at Johns Hopkins University, Imperial College of London, people like Roland Griffiths, people like Robin Carhart-Harris and other, well, you call them visionaries, you know, Rick Doblin from the Multidisciplinary Association of Psychedelic Studies, MAPS.org. These people understand the promise of these compounds.
Yeah. Well, I'm just saying that, you know, and they're all in my movie because I knew, well, I mean, like 5 or 6 years ago when I interviewed them, that was all about doing the medical research, but they're also people that have foresight.
Yeah, they have foresight. And what I like about what they're doing is they're putting the suit and tie. You know, they understand how to go make their case to organizations that are a bit more straight-laced. And I appreciate that because I think, look, I love the iconography of the 1960s. I love the music that came from that era. I love that it woke people up and it did change the world. But I also think it fell short of what it could have been because some of its more prominent faces were so caught up in the ego-destroying power of psychedelics that they fell in love with the sound of their own voice and their egos got really, 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 really big. And they felt that maybe they didn't need to go through the natural the paths at the time to really move the needle the way that it might have been moved. But again, no regrets. What happened, happened. Yeah. But I appreciate that now it's like, now I can go to a corporate conference and I can talk about Johns Hopkins University studies with people with treatment-resistant depression being given psilocybin in a controlled environment and no longer meeting the criteria for depression. I can talk about phase 3 clinical trials or a breakthrough therapy designation for MDMA when people that have been traumatized in war and have horrible PTSD can do one session with a therapist and no longer meet the criteria for PTSD. So I can get in front of a corporate audience, you know, wearing a button-down shirt and speak to that. I can go to the International Criminal Court in the Netherlands and speak to a bunch of ambassadors, including ambassadors to Saudi Arabia and other places, and talk about this because now the citations and the studies and the legitimacy behind the institutions that are doing this work makes it so that it's not as threatening to the man. And that's important. It's important. Like the last thing you want to do to change the world, even if you think you're changing it for the better, is lighting the world on fire and watching it burn so you can create something new. Like I do not support that way of changing any system. I just really don't. Not at this point, at least. Yeah. I think where we are now is you dress it up. You address the questions. You learn how to speak to every audience. You know, I think even the most conservative audience, even the people who are most nervous or anxious about cannabis and psychedelics, people who are still drunk on drug war rhetoric. I mean, if you sit down, you talk about that with them and you tell them the amount of people that are committing suicide, the level of depression and anxiety, you talk to them about people coming back from war with PTSD and how this is the only thing that's helping them, all of a sudden their whole resistance to it shifts. Right. You know, people respond in a more compassionate way. And now you're getting somewhere. So for that reason, I'm excited about everything that's happening in that space. And I should say that I appreciate also that we're putting checks and balances on it, that we're putting frameworks on it, that we're putting guardrails on it, because what I don't appreciate is the over-enthusiasm of people, you know, flying down to Costa Rica to meet with their friend's friend who supposedly is a shaman who's giving them some potent psychoactive compound without proper psychological screening and risking an experience that might re-traumatize the person. So what I'm in full support of is the responsible research, use, and deployment of these compounds to alleviate mental distress, and then moving past that, what Michael Pollan describes as making well people better, so that we should have the opportunity to stargate to these realms using these compounds, but with the proper guardrails, protocols, and procedures in place to avoid a runaway train of problems.
Sure. Well, you know, Jason, I'm not sure if I shared this with you, but, you know, starting this month, we're going to be doing a clinical trial at the Pacific Neuroscience Institute at St. John's in Santa Monica, where we're going to treat people with alcohol addiction, alcohol disorders.
Beautiful.
Psilocybin, and combined with my imagery in terms of set and setting, because here you are in a box called a hospital room. We can take
exactly
into nature, but through time and scale, right? Yes. Altered perception that 100%. Can sort of get you in the mood of letting go. And I think that, you know, that study, and then we have another study happening at UCSD in La Jolla, where we're going to combine aromatherapy with my visual imagery, again, to treat people with stress and anxiety. So I do want to, there's a great question I want to share for both of us. This is from Daniel. He said, during a psychedelic experience with the sense of discovering new connections, you feel flooded with a sense of discovery and insight. However, it seems that it's difficult to retain with clarity and the ability to articulate on the other side more than a nugget or two of insights have received. Are there any techniques to cement those discoveries? And to pause on that, think about that for a second, Jason, but I want to share what I know from that experience. And that is, I believe it's similar to like getting in a helicopter and flying up to Everest and getting a look at it. And then you got to fly back to base camp. And the next day you got to do the hike. You get a glimpse of what it is, but you got to do the work.
Mm-hmm. No, that's fair. I mean, you know, even before answering that, you know, going back to the work you're doing with facilitating people having psychedelic experiences while looking at the imagery of your movies, Adventures in Time and Scale, is the reason that's so important to inform people's experiences is because psychedelic experiences by their very nature are so very plastic. That's something that nobody really talks about, how malleable they are to set and setting. Not just that set and setting affects the experience, but really that set and setting authors the experience. Yeah. Before psychedelics were called psychedelics, which means mind manifesting, they were called psychotomimetics, which means psychosis mimicking drugs. And they used to give them to people in like weird fluorescent lit hospital wards and told them this is going to mimic psychosis. So what you're doing is you're priming somebody and then you're giving them a compound that increases reactivity and receptivity to stimuli. So you're making them more suggestible and then you're feeding them suggestions once you've made them more suggestible based on your set and setting. So we shouldn't forget also that how we design these set and settings has a kind of ethical code written underneath it. You know, Jamie Weil talks about this in his upcoming book, Recapture the Rapture, Rethinking God, Sex, and Death in a World That's Lost Its Mind. He talks about ethical cult building. Because again, when somebody is on a psychedelic experience, their suggestibility is so amped and their heightened qualitative intensity, their presence in the moment is so amped that you could potentially feed them anything you want. Right? You could make the wrong suggestions. You could say, I am your guru, and now you have to follow me. I mean, in these moments of ecstasis, people become putty in your hands. And so we have a responsibility if we're going to be creating these spaces where people can undergo these kinds of experiences that we're not feeding them our agendas, right? So it's like, how do you design an agendaless set and setting that engenders the person's natural transformation. Okay, we might argue that nature is neutral, or that, you know, Beethoven music is neutral. But what if we start putting a script into people's experiences? What if we start telling them what to think? I mean, these are ethical dilemmas that are going to come up, because I think a lot of people just assume that the psychedelic has a script built into the molecule, and it doesn't. The script is your background, your personality, expectation, and temperament, and your immediate environment. That's what scripts the experience. So what we have really is what Eric Davis calls technologies of experience, perhaps the greatest information technologies we've ever been given, because the very technical material of subjectivity is up for grabs. Our very interiority, the very landscape that looks out, is now fully malleable, like a wonderful theater, right? Like a tabula rasa. And we can set design that theater to transport people to wherever the play is going to take place. Mm-hmm. So, you know, and I see the rise potentially of like psychedelic programmers that are like artists, that are like stage designers, that are people that become celebrated for the way they craft or set design, like wedding planners for psychedelic experiences that get voted on. You know, I could imagine people coming on a hike with me and smoking cannabis, and I create like a Jason Silva playlist and a topic, a series of conversations as we walk through some hidden cenotes in Tulum. Because what I'm doing there is I'm crafting a particular kind of ride. I'm priming people for expectation. I'm making them suggestible and open by offering them some cannabis. And then I'm creating a surrounding that further informs and feeds back into the feedback loop metaphor, feeds back into their experience. You know, one of the things Rich Doyle wrote about in Darwin's Pharmacy is that the one thing he calls them ecodelics, that ecodelics reveal, is how your creative and linguistic choices inform your experience. See, your creative and linguistic choices, your set and setting in your everyday non-drugged life, non-psychoactive life, your set and setting is always shaping your experience. You know, the psychological impact of boring buildings was an article in New York Magazine about how an office space, the color on the wall, we talked about this in Brain Games, can make you depressed. You know, bad design leads to like dark thoughts and like rumination and stress. You know, so you can design for better trips even without the drug based on how you calibrate your set and setting. But what psychoactive compounds can teach you is a very visceral appreciation for how your creative and linguistic choices do shape your experience. You know, try smoking a joint one day in a state where it's legal, and then listen to a Bob Marley song, and then realize in that moment, wow, I am a different person, or I become a different experience when I hit play on Three Little Birds than before I hit played on it, right? And especially when you're so suggestible, you're not listening to the music anymore. You're becoming the music now. And that is the most empowering thing on the planet, because it means my creative and linguistic choices govern my fate. I design, therefore I become. And that for me is the most ecstatic realization. You know, Leary called this internal freedom. David Lenson calls it the stewardship of internal life, that I literally can exercise judiciously my agency to curate, calibrate, and design my set and setting so that I am literally on a magic carpet ride called my life. And that's, I think, the best thing that can be learned from these trips. But again, if we're the gatekeepers and the placeholders and those that are creating those set and settings are going to become culture makers. And they have a responsibility not to lead us astray. That was a rant.
I love that. Look, that's what I think, you know, Fantastic Fungi is for a lot of people. I mean, they felt that it was a trip. A lot of people that have never done it before, you know, come up to me afterwards and they go, you know, I've had a lot of fear. There's been like, you know, propaganda, like, where can I go to experience it? And like right now, there's a limited funnel where, you know, it's being used in medical research.
Yeah.
And, but I think that, you know, as you said earlier, like, you know, and Michael Pollan said, you know, well, people need to get better. There's no reason why not. Even with cannabis, it went down that same path. It was first medical.
Yeah.
And, but like for the guy that's got two kids, they finally are to bed and it's like, it's been a rough day. Like for him to take a toke at the end of a day, why not? And how could that even be illegal? To think that Timothy Leary went to jail for 10 years because they found two roaches on him, you know, which was maybe planted. Again, that's like, wow, we have come like a long distance, right?
No, absolutely. And I would say we actually have a name for people that program psychedelic experiences. They're called artists, Louis. You know what I mean? I mean, it's like when I see Fantastic Fungi or I see your moving art pieces, I see you're like another Beethoven, right? Like you are for the attending mind, right? Because William James said your experience is what you attend to. So for the attending mind, attending to moving art is becoming moving art. It's being transported. It's the evanescent, having evanescent lightning bolts of meaning as you behold these landscapes. I mean, you are, for the attending mind, they are becoming that experience. Just like for the attending mind to a Beethoven symphony or the attending mind to a Vivaldi symphony, same thing. There's a great book on this called The Artist as Shaman, which is saying that basically artists were the original shamans. You know, now it's so trendy to say, yeah, my shaman friend in Tulum is going to guide you, this and that. I'm like, dude, like, every talented musician is a shaman. Every playwright is a shaman. Chris Nolan, the director, is a shaman. I mean, people who don't think that movies, especially good movies, are psychedelic experiences, don't understand what psychedelic experiences are.
So one of the deep feelings I think we do get, you know, from these experiences is, again, that feeling of connection. Mm-hmm. And, you know, right now during this pandemic, I would say that the worst outcome be, you know, certainly recognizing the suffering, the people that are dying, is this feeling of disconnection from each other. Something we all took for granted, you know, having your friends, your family, going out to dinner. We got a short video I want to show about connection. Perfect. And maybe after, like, we look at this short little piece on connection.
Perfect.
Where do we come out on the other side of this particular pandemic? You know,
okay.
What is the reboot that we need to do? Okay.
Okay.
All right, cool. Let's show connection.
When I think about connection, I think about intersubjectivity. I think about the human capacity to pierce beyond the veil of individuation and to enter the holy other, to blast new tunnels between the mind and the other. We resist, we refuse to live alone inside of our own minds. Instead, we crave an intersubjective ecstasy. We crave a crossing over. We create cinema that allows us to experience a deictic shift, to enter the subjectivity, the interiority of another person. That's why cinema is an engine of empathy, because it allows you to enter that something else, that someone else, that somewhere else, to pierce the veil that separates us from one another, to enter a kind of technologically mediated Buddhism, to create an internet that links together billions of minds, transcending time, space, and distance, collapsing geography. All becomes one. What is within becomes without. This is kind of wonderful, right? When I think about connections, I think about understanding, which, as Carl Sagan says, is a kind of ecstasy. So that with comprehension comes meaning, comes signification. That's what I think about when I think about connection.
Ha! Amen. So where do we come out on the other side? I'm sure you've heard all the studies. There'll probably be a giant mental health crisis. You know,
oh, no doubt, dude. It's traumatic. So it's traumatic.
What do you think would be the reboot?
What if we, after we vaccinate everyone, we set up mass clinics to give people MDMA? Mass MDMA centers in like public parks or something. No,
we'll have to prioritize. It'll be like veterans first,
right?
And people over 65,
right?
And then politicians,
yes.
And then the rest of us,
yes, exactly. yeah, no, this was a crazy year, 2020. I mean, I never experienced anything like that. Like the having been the forced to stay at home, the stay at home stuff, and the panic and the fear of the other. And every time you saw a human, you moved away, having to wear a mask. I mean, it's traumatic. But you know, the deeper the trauma, the deeper the catharsis, right? So I choose to walk the path of the optimist and say we're going to come out of this, and it's going to be a beautiful spring, a beautiful renaissance. You know, I pay attention to areas where there has been progress. I think medicine is about to be like massively transformed for the better. I think the science, the technology behind these new mRNA vaccines is astonishing. The hard work of scientists to create a vaccine that has 95% efficacy in a matter of months, you know, by like taking the genome of the virus and figuring out the part that we need to destroy. I mean, it's just, it's astonishing science. And so what I see actually is us, when we do get to the other side of this, realizing, oh, wow, those that said, oh, we'll never return to the pre-pandemic world, will be pleasantly surprised by realizing that not only will things go back to the pre-pandemic world, but they might actually improve from the pre-pandemic world because of the progress we're seeing in psychedelic therapy, because of what we've just seen finally in the election, moving to perhaps, you know, a sane administration and a return to facts and truth. So I am optimistic. You know, I think that the work you're doing, Louis, and so many others, you know, empowered using these technologies of communication, have doubled down on making their art and making this content. And so many people have had a less painful experience during this time because of it. But I think we're going to be all right.
Yeah.
There's pain out there. There's suffering, no doubt. But I think we're going to come out of this.
Yeah. I think one of the things also about wonder and awe, it really makes you appreciate and have gratitude for all the things we take for granted, the little things in life, like, you know, being able to have, you know, friends and family, to be able to have blue sky. I mean, during the fires, it was something I took for granted.
Oh my God, no.
Sky. I never thought I had to wake up and be grateful for blue sky. You know? But yeah. The way the pandemic did put a pause button on the planet, and no power was ever as big as that, where there was blue sky in Beijing, right? And I hadn't seen that probably in a couple of decades.
Yeah.
I think there's a silver lining in that we need to be able to say, what can we do better? You know, the world did not collapse. Everyone's right. Been talking about, you know, the economy. I mean, we need to, like, you know, remodel ourselves, right? We need to find out there's no reason why we can't have a sustainable energy grid, right?
For sure.
And actually, Jason, you really, I love the way you also riff on technology.
Yeah.
And hacking the brain.
Yeah.
So, okay. So here we are in this dark moment, but also I said there's a bright moment. Never before has science and technology, you know, raced as fast as it's going. How do you think that can make us more human? We know the downside of some of the stuff on social media. We're not going to maybe get into that. But on a positive side, how can we hack the brain to be better people?
Yeah. Look, technology has always been a double-edged sword. When we domesticated fire, all of a sudden we could burn the village next door. That was terrible, right? The weaponization of that force of nature. But domesticating fire also became the beginning of cooking. Mm-hmm. And before we could cook our food, human beings spent most of their waking hours chewing, right? Now, once we could cook food using fire, that acted as an external prosthetic stomach, a piece of technology that pre-digested our food so that when we ate it, we could absorb it and stay full enough, long enough to do something else besides chewing. So we have a symbiotic relationship with technology and innovation. We wouldn't be who we are without technology and innovation. So any dismissal of technology makes no sense. What I think troubles some people is the misuse of technology or the wasteful use of technology or having a non-circular economy. But I see those as stepping stones. You know, those were stepping stones to get us to where we're getting to now, which is increasingly the realization that we have to go fully renewable and that we can go fully renewable, that we have the technical capacity and proficiency to do this. What was missing perhaps is popular will, but that's changing very fast. Now, you look at this pandemic, horrible economic effects on a lot of people and all this suffering. But what's very interesting is all these people working remote, right? And maybe some people like miss the office, they miss their colleagues, but there's also this popular meme of like office work as like drudgery, right? Like you're a cog in the machine, like punching in, punching out, you know, every day in an office in the big cubicle, et cetera. And I read a number that said that on the other side of this, up to 40% of Americans are now going to work remote. And there was a Wall Street Journal article saying that, post-COVID is going to lead to an era of full-time travel, where what was a small category before of digital nomads is now expanding to fit potentially 40% of American workers that now realizing they can work remotely, they're like, why am I living in an expensive neighborhood in SF or Brooklyn when I can go live in Barbados with a digital nomad visa, or Bali or Estonia or Croatia or Iceland? All these countries have announced digital nomad visas, which allow workers who work online, who can work from anywhere, to live in these countries and not pay local taxes because their work is online, as long as you can prove you can support yourself. This would not be possible without technology. So I think it's going to free workers around the world from the desk and from the cubicle to be like sipping organic smoothies in Bali while they get their work done on their laptops. 40% of workers potentially. That's all thanks to technology. That's technology freeing us, you know?
Right. Well, you are the pioneer of the digital nomad, I think.
I try to be.
As long as I've known you, I go, Jason, what's happening? But where are you?
Yeah.
It's either Amsterdam or Tulum or some other like exotic location, because, you know, you had a speaking gig here on the way back. You thought you'd drop, you know, stop off in Iceland.
Yeah.
And the fact that I think you've told me, as long as you got your laptop with me, you're good to go.
So, I can make my content now with my iPhone and a little microphone under my shirt and get that posted right away. And the feeling for me, the freedom, you know, like Timothy Leary, he came up with the term, the stand-up philosopher. You know, he said in the information age, you don't teach philosophy, you perform it. If Aristotle were alive today, he'd have a talk show. This is Leary in the 60s, but what a prescient idea. You don't teach philosophy, you perform it. You know, I've always felt that in my videos, They are these expressions or these performances that are directly in response to the experience that I've engendered in sacred space. So my videos are, they're portals. They're a glimpse of the experience of the mythopoetic realm, and just allowing that to speak itself out through me is such a gift. And the fact that now I'm not even attached to a studio or a crew, it's the ultimate, creatively, the ultimate liberation.
Well, I think that takes a ton of energy to do. And you've got a lot of energy. And I want to share one other really short clip with our audience, because I asked, you know, Jason at one point to, you know, talk about energy, do a riff on energy. And let's take a look at it and we'll talk about it on the other side. Okay.
When I think about energy, I think about what energizes me, what makes me come alive. There's that great quote that says, ask not what the world needs, ask instead what makes you come alive, because what the world needs is more people who have come alive. So when I think of energy, I think of passion, I think of human imagination, I think about creativity, I think about existential angst, I think about boredom as a kind of meaning withdrawal, something that agitates something within that makes you say, I gotta get up, I got to move, I gotta create something in the world. Ernest Becker says we are creatures that are simultaneously gods and worms. With our minds, we can ponder the infinite, yet we're housed in heart-pumping, breath-gasping, decaying bodies. We fancy ourselves as gods, but we are doomed to be food for worms. And that agitation, that tension, energizes us, and it makes us want to remake the world. It has pushed us beyond the boundaries of biology to become a geological force. That is what it means to be human. That is what I think about when I think of energy.
Amen. Woo! So, let me tell you where I have a special connection to the word energy. Mm-hmm. The name of my company when I first started in 1974 was called, you know, Energy Productions, Energy Film Library, which Getty eventually acquired in 1996. But I was in college. I hitchhiked up the coast. I may have taken a psychedelic, and I was on the border between Oregon and California. And I had the Pacific Ocean in front of me. I had redwood trees off to my right. There was a giant sand dune off to my left. And I had, you know, a still camera at the time. I was doing still photography. And my lens couldn't capture it all, you know. And I almost took my camera and threw it in the ocean because it was just too much, you know. And I realized, well, how do you describe what I'm experiencing? And there was only one word that popped into me, and that was energy. That it's a all energy. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and this was, I think, before people started using the word a lot, whether it was the energy crisis or I'm low on energy. It was mostly used to describe, like, you know, a fuel. Yeah. But energy, I think, is a spiritual word. The closest word that I could find, the only one word that can encompass everything. What are your thoughts?
People often will use the word ineffable when they try to account for experiences like the one you just spoke about. Our friend Decker, who studied awe, you know, I think his team were the ones that said that awe is an experience of such perceptual expansion that our mental maps, which includes how we language, are forced into a state of accommodation. So it's like we need new words for these territories. We need new maps for these territories. But those new maps are only born after annihilation. Terence McKenna calls it a quaking, annihilating glory. Is that moment when you saw the redwood trees and the ocean and the sun, and it's just like starlight, dude, starlight, star bright, you know? And while I think empirical language or a journalistic account of what transpired there for you and for people who have these experiences leaves us short. And so that's why people say words won't do. I think that poetic language can account for these experiences. So Alain de Botton has a very interesting, he's a British philosopher. He says, a journalist may be more accurate in describing the details of an event than a poet. So like the journalist might say, well, Louis Schwartzberg was driving through the redwoods and the ocean, he was on LSD and it made him more suggestible. And so he was overwhelmed by the heightened qualitative intensity of his brain in that moment, of his subjectivity in that moment. So yeah, the journalist may be more accurate in describing in empirical details what was transpiring, says Alain de Botton, but a poet may nevertheless reveal truth of a deeper sort, as he calls it, beyond the literal grid. Now, this gets us into a very interesting space, because what does it mean, truth of a deeper sort? There's either empirical truth, and, you know, you're entitled to your own opinions, but not to your own facts, right? That's we're living in the age of misinformation, and we're trying to tell people, no, there's some stuff that's non-debatable, right? We need consensus reality when it comes to certain things. However, your experience, interior experiences, poetic experiences, can be accounted for in language that is poetic, which you might call, again, a truth of a deeper sort beyond the literal grid. So empirical reality or journalistic reality or material reality or scientific reality versus poetic reality or spiritual reality or the truth of a deeper sort beyond the literal grid is a little bit like separating church and state. Now, we decided that in America, we have to separate church and state. Why? Because when it comes to church, the Christian, the Pentecostal, the Jew, the Muslim, everybody's got their own interpretation, just like everybody's psychedelic trip has a different language used to describe it. So as long as you say your church is just for you, right? Your mythopoetic and poetic experience, it's not scripture that I have to follow, but it's your poetry. And if you publish it as such, as your poetry, that's beautiful. However, the consensus reality, the journalistic reality, the factual, scientific, material reality is one we all have to agree with. But that doesn't mean that it can't exist side by side with our own mythopoetic reality. So somebody has a psychedelic trip and they see God. That's fine. You saw God. I don't care. I'm not going to disprove or prove what you saw. The only thing I care about is the epistemic value of that. If you saw God and it made you a nicer person who contributed to his community, who's kinder to people, we can measure that. So I like that. But keep your own poetry, or rather keep your own spiritual experience, your own mythopoetic truth, either to yourself, or if you're sharing it, label it poetry.
Right.
Don't label it empirical truth. That's when we get into problems. Because then everybody who has a spiritual experience thinks that he gets to be the next Jesus and tell you what your scripture should be. And right. We don't want to allow that. In fact, that's one of the biggest dangers of psychedelic gurus. all of a sudden they feel like they get to tell you what you need to think. I'm like, no, you don't.
Yeah.
I'm glad you had a beautiful experience. I have my own beautiful experience. But we must agree upon the set of frameworks that allow us to drive on a freeway without crashing into each other. And that's the sort of empirical journalistic account of the facts. When the airplane takes off, when you put fuel in it, when pay the electric bill by this day. So that you keep those separate, church and state, church and state, church and state, literal and mythopoetic. Keep them separate.
Well, and there are people that, you know, don't want to really challenge themselves to explore the mystery. You know, the people that are the true believers, unfortunately, that's another aspect of wonder and awe. The folks who want to be told what to believe, as you just described, and whether they're, followers of Trump, there is something scary about that, because when you see thousands of people chanting either Sieg Heil or hang him, that presses the same button, according to Dacher Keltner, as wonder and awe, because now you're infinitesimal in the grand scheme of things.
Oh, yeah. No, those people are experiencing a bliss fuck crucifixion in that moment. They're martyrs for their cause. They're jihadis. You can't say that those jihadis or those people that stormed the Capitol weren't they weren't intoxicated by a religious-like experience in their subjectivity.
Yeah.
That's exactly what I'm talking about. The poetic truth is that they were fucking soldiers on a journey. You know, they were Lord of the Rings. They were on a mystical, rapturous war, right? That's their mythopoetic truth. The literal truth is that they're breaking the law and they're acting like morons, terrorists, and very, very cruel people. And they were not abiding by the frameworks that we have set forth for the literal truth, right? Or yeah. The empirical set of facts about what happened in the election, what the courts have determined is the truth, and so on and so forth. So yes, psychedelic space, mythopoetic space can be weaponized. It goes back to the idea of who's programming your set and setting, you know, and ethical cult building. Because when somebody is in the fervor of intoxication, you can introduce any content you want and they're much more receptive to it.
Well, not only do I agree, we have a great comment from Heather McLean. She says on Facebook that nature is a manifestation of that spiritual energy, one that we can agree on. It's one reason why Louis's work is a gateway. And to echo what you were saying earlier, I just think it's paramount that we all listen to your inner voice, because you are always going to be your own best friend and your own guide. And you have to nurture that. You know, it's not an easy thing to do, because we're inundated with all this data and information and, you know, and who do you get to follow, believe, listen, watch, whatever it might be, to have the quiet, which is hard to do, just to hear who you are. I mean, I try to wake up every morning and try to have that blank slate experience and ask myself, who am I? What's it all about? You know, I don't know. I don't have that answer. I don't want to have that answer. I don't want it to be predetermined.
Yeah.
I want that childlike sense of wonder.
Yeah. Well, I want to create beauty, and I want to uplift people's hearts, and I want to uplift my own heart. I think Joseph Campbell said something to the degree of, you're not on a quest to save the world, but to save yourself. And in doing so, you save the world. And there's something to that, right? It's like, if you heal your own stuff, the epistemic likelihood, the output is that you're probably going to be better for it to others and through your contributions. So work on this first, you know?
I agree. And I think that, like, that's what we're doing right now in the moment, is we're sharing that with all of our listeners so that they can take that deep dive on their own inner journey, appreciating all the great work that, you know, people like Jason have done. You can see his Shots of Awe on YouTube. It's, for me, a caffeinated explosion of joy and beauty. And every time I watch one of them, it opens up my neural pathways into thinking differently about something, you know, which is a gift, because I don't ever want to get regimented, or, you know, as I get older, I want to keep on expanding my awareness.
Yeah.
You know? And we want to, you know, that I think that's our goal. We got to shift consciousness, like you said earlier, you know, in terms of the environmental issues and everything else. Like, why haven't we changed our behavior when we have all the answers at our feet?
Yeah.
Below our feet, literally under the ground with the mycelial network. You know, so it's right there. And right there. What's going to take for us to become a little bit more conscious? Yeah. You know? And I believe art is certainly the way.
Yeah. Art is the lie that reveals the truth. Could end with a beautiful quote by Ursula Le Guin. She said, science describes accurately from the outside. Poetry describes accurately from the inside. Science explicates. Poetry implicates. Both celebrate what they describe.
Celebrating life. Amen. Thank you, Amen. Jason. I want to thank everybody that's tuned in. There's a bunch of questions. I think what we might be able to do is, in order to answer all of them, go to movingart.com and we'll reply. Jason maybe can help reply to some of these questions, you know, online afterwards, if that's cool with you. And I want to also thank the Fetzer Institute for sponsoring our podcast and helping build a spiritual foundation for a loving world. I mean, how cool is that to have a foundation whose mission it is to create a loving world? I can buy that. As well as I want to be able to thank my team. And I want to thank my team, you know, with Leland and Annie and Courtney and Sarah from Moving Art, Bethany, Ron, Diana from Magical Threads. This has been a joyful, blissful journey having this conversation with you, Jason, and to be continued. Thank you, everybody.
Much appreciated. Thank you for your beautiful work, Louis. Great to see you. Thank you to everybody for listening, and blessings.
All right. Have a gorgeous day.